You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last month, the Food and Drug Administration took the first steps toward issuing a ban on the widespread use of antibiotics in the feed and water given to livestock. It was in response to the concerns of many scientists of a possible threat to public health caused by the overuse of antibiotics, leading to the evolution of drug-resistant strains of bacteria. Joining us now to look into those dangers, why antibiotics are used so widely in animal feed, and the challenges the FDA faces in issuing new stricter policies are Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, and contributing writer for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and Brian Walsh, staff writer for Time magazine. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Brian, what did the FDA call for in the policy document they released last month?
Well, essentially they called for more judicious use of antibiotics within veterinary production. I mean, it's sort of a guidance. It's not necessarily a new regulation. It may not actually change much, although industry generally does listen to what they're saying. They want industry to basically stop using so much in the way of antibiotics for growth promotion. Try to be a little bit more judicious in the way it's using them, as opposed to just the way it is now, which you see a lot being used simply to speed the growth of animals, help them, frankly, live in the kind of factory farm conditions most of them are being raised in right now.
But it's rather hazy, isn't it? My idea of what a judicious use is might be a little different than the next guy's.
That's exactly true, and that's the problem. Of course, the industry has a lot of sway on regulation here, and of course, the FDA is not the USDA, which is doing most of the work of overseeing animal production. So it's far from clear exactly what this will actually mean. But at the same time, I mean, it sort of shows just how much sway industry has had over this process, that even the very fact that the FDA is coming out and saying publicly, look, this is a concern, this is something we need to be worried about, this is something industry does need to address, is actually seen as kind of a landmark.
Maren, how long have farmers been giving low doses of antibiotics to livestock as a regular practice?
An amazingly long time. It's really surprising how long this has been going on, and that it's really just kind of coming to people's consciousness now. It actually goes back about 50 years, and it really was sort of an accident at first. A couple of scientists who were working on brewing one of the first antibiotics really needed to do something with the leftovers. The way you make an antibiotic, at least the way people made them sort of back in the day, is kind of like making beer. You take a lot of carbohydrate, you inoculate it with the organisms, and then you brew them up in a reactor vessel, and it leaves you with all this mash. And so they gave this mash to chickens and discovered that the chickens grew faster. It turns out because of trace amounts of the antibiotics that were left in that mash from brewing them. And that went from an accidental discovery to an enormous industry in which these tiny, tiny doses, not a treatment dose, not something that will treat an existing disease, but something that's much, much smaller than that, sometimes even just a hundredth, is routinely given to animals because it makes them grow up to market weight faster. And if you're growing very large amounts of animals as a commodity and you want to get them off the farm faster, that's something that makes a lot of sense. So it's been going now for 4 or 5 decades.
And do we know why animals tend to grow bigger and faster when they're fed low doses of antibiotics?
An intriguing scientific question that's never really been decided. Probably the best explanation is that those tiny doses of antibiotics do something to quell other infections that the animals already have. They have bacteria in their guts the way all of us do. And if those are kept under control, or if parasites are kept under control, then the animals can spend less of their energy fighting those infections and more of their energy extracting nutrition from food and using it to build muscle.
Brian, what position has the FDA taken on this non-therapeutic use of antibiotics up until now?
So far, they haven't really come out with a position against. I mean, that is what makes what happened here so noteworthy. I mean, the fact that the FDA is beginning to deal with this in the past under the Bush administration, you never really saw what you're seeing now, which is the FDA looking and seeing that the resistance that may be coming out of the use, the incredible use of antibiotics in food animal production, is going to have an impact, is already probably having an impact on human health, and this is now something that they need to step forward and actually try to exert some authority on.
Well, we've been hearing about this for a long time now, at least my listeners have. because people have been coming on the show and talking about it. Has there been pressure from the medical community and consumers to get the FDA to do something about it?
There has been pressure, and it has been growing. I mean, you've seen it's I think growing as a concern. It's you mentioned, and the public is beginning to understand this, but for the medical community, I'm sure Marin can talk about this. It's been something they're increasingly worried about. They're seeing a rise in the number of antibiotic resistant infections in human beings, and you're looking and you see if you're delivering this many antibiotics, and the truth is no one really has a firm fix on how much of these drugs are actually being used on animals. There are different estimates out there, and they vary widely, but there is no one firm number. But we know it's quite a lot. If you're seeing that much out there, that has to be a human health concern. And traditionally, human health, veterinary health, there's been a wall between them. And I think that's beginning to break down in recent years, partially out of concerns for food safety. I think partially also a little bit out of concerns for seeing with something like bird flu, the way that animal health can actually impact human beings. Now, hopefully, this is going to be something that's going to change, but the truth is, you know, the human health industry only has, or the oversight, doesn't exactly have a lot of sway over what goes on in animal production. And that's a very powerful industry, very hard to change.
And you said the real agency here that could change things is the USDA. Do you think that this might lead to policy changes at the USDA?
I'd be pretty skeptical of that. You know, I mean, they're an industry that's has a lot. I mean, like, as I said, ag has a lot of sway over them, and, you know, it'd be very surprising for me to really see them change. I mean, certainly the Secretary, Tom Vilsack, is someone who comes from a farm state, someone who understands or, you know, who talks about the importance of the modern agricultural system we have now. So to see that suddenly change, and this is a huge issue for industry. I mean, they are when they are attacked on this, they respond in kind, and so I'm pretty skeptical that USDA would be the agency to take the lead and really switch on this.
Marin, something Brian said reminded me that according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, 70% of all antibiotics used in this country are used in animal agriculture to promote growth, but the Animal Health Institute, which represents the agriculture industry, says that it's only 13%. That's a huge difference.
And that estimate by the Union of Concerned Scientists is about 10 years old at this point. And the fact that that's the only good estimate we have shows how tight control agriculture keeps on information about the use of antibiotics. One of the biggest issues here with the amount of antibiotics that are used in agriculture in the United States and the effect of that on human health is that we have very little data. And we have very little data because we don't keep track. We don't insist on agriculture keeping track of where antibiotics are used or what antibiotics are used. We don't have any kind of surveillance of the animals, not any comprehensive surveillance of what kind of antibiotic-resistant organisms emerge in animals and move to humans as a result. And that's all despite the fact that scientific research has been saying since the 1970s that there's a direct link between what goes on in animals on the farm and what affects humans. We can actually see, as molecular science has improved, that those exact strains, the fingerprinted strains, are moving from one realm to the other. It's really not a scientific question anymore. As Brian says, it's a political question.
Didn't something happen in the Netherlands in 2004 that showed that connection?
I love this story because it really is the story that makes the case that what goes on the farm is a concern for human health. And the story starts with a six-month-old girl who needed heart surgery. She was a blue baby. She had a hole in her heart. The Netherlands is a place that's always had incredible control of that one particular drug-resistant organism called MRSA in its hospitals. If you have to go into a hospital in the Netherlands, they will check you to see if you're carrying MRSA on your skin or in your nostrils, and they'll treat you. They'll put you in isolation and treat you before they let you into the general population of the hospital. Well, this little girl had a MRSA strain, which was very unusual in the Netherlands. In fact, it didn't actually make sense on the tests that they use. And when they checked it back, they traced it back through her life. They found her parents had it, her parents' friends had it. They were all pig farmers, and it was in the pigs on those people's farms. And what was especially notable and sort of rang the alarm bell is that that strain that this little girl had was resistant to a drug that was being given to the pigs. And the Netherlands has had a fairly recent conversion from small family-scale farming to large industrial-scale farming, where much more antibiotics are being given to pigs. And so the signal of that antibiotic resistance in that strain in the pigs affecting this family and subsequently many other families and outbreaks across the European Union and even now in Canada and starting to emerge in the U.S. was a clear signal that what goes on in animals given antibiotics does affect human health.
Now, the title of your book is Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, M-R-S-A. And you say antibiotics can't control it. It's a drug-resistant staph.
You know, MRSA is, or MRSA, as some people say, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, is the most troublesome organism in what is really an international epidemic of drug-resistant organisms. Now, it's important to say here, because we've been talking about the effect of antibiotics used in animal agriculture, that human medicine plays a role here as well, that we misuse antibiotics in animal agriculture and also in human medicine as well. But over the past 50, 60 years, as we have brought out new antibiotics, organisms with MRSA in the lead have become more and more resistant, not just in hospitals, but also out in the community as well, so that there are some serious infections now for which there are only one or two drugs that work. And physicians say every day, I feel like I don't know how to treat my patients. Someday soon, I will have an infection that's untreatable.
Brian, isn't the use of these antibiotics with the animals expensive for farmers?
Well, I mean, it's not. I mean, not if you compare what the cost they believe, at least, it would be to actually having to treat them more therapeutically. I mean, their hold basically, their statement is that if you use these for growth, promotion, feed efficiency, you also don't need to use as many to actually treat them for diseases. In fact, one great example is what Denmark has done. Now, Denmark in the 90s actually did more than what the FDA is talking about here. They actually banned the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics for their animal production. And they saw. This is used as an example for those who want to do this. I mean, they saw no real change in the productivity of the pork industry, the swine industry, and the swine industry in Denmark it's not an organic one. It's a fairly industrial one in within Europe. It did very well. Now, what the people who, you know, what the animal industry, the food industry here points at, they said they saw an increase in the amount of antibiotics that were being used to treat diseases there, a reduction overall, but more being used to treat diseases. I mean, to me, and I actually had a chance to visit Denmark last December, spend some time with pork farmers. I mean, it seemed, talking to them, that this is something they adjusted to. You know, it took a period to get used to, but now they find their animals are healthier. They're not as worried as antibiotic resistance. They don't have a problem with that to the degree that they did before. So to me, I mean, the Denmark example does show that you can do this on a fairly industrial scale and reduce the threat both to animals but also to human beings as well.
So instead of giving it to every animal, they only gave antibiotics to animals that got sick. Humans need prescriptions to get antibiotics. Do farmers need prescriptions to get these drugs?
Actually, no, they don't.
Right, exactly.
I live out here in the Midwest, and I can go down to a farm supply store with no prescription. And, you know, if I had a farm, I could buy antibiotic-laced feed. In fact, there are people whom I've met out here who have told me that though everyone talks about people going to Canada for cheaper prescription drugs, there are people out here in the Midwest who'll go to a farm supply store to buy their prescriptions instead because they don't actually need a prescription. And one of the things that happened in Denmark when they made that change in their antibiotic use is that they involved veterinarians in the provision of antibiotics on farms. And that's something that would happen under some legislation that's pending in the United States right now. But Denmark's change was, in a way, kind of a jobs bill for veterinarians. And one of the reasons why it's relatively inexpensive for farmers to use antibiotics on their own in this country is because veterinarians don't have to be involved.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more of this discussion about antibiotics in agriculture with Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. It is published by Free Press. She's also a contributing writer for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and with Brian Walsh, who's a staff writer for Time magazine. Stay with us. We're back with our look at the effect of antibiotics in agriculture on Animals and People with Brian Walsh, staff writer for Time magazine, and Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. A number of listeners have been writing in with questions. One asks, which antibiotics are most commonly given to animals this way? Are they the same kinds of drugs used on humans? And a follow-up to that is Sally on the Upper East Side once says, I know several people with allergies to penicillin. Have there been any studies on the effects of this meat on those people? And do these antibiotics give the animals any discomfort? Which one of you wants to? Brian, you want to start? And then Maren, you can pick it up?
Sure. I know that you have a common. You often see penicillin, tetracycline. Those are often given to cattle, to other food animals. So you do see a lot of crossover between the same type of antibiotics that are used for animals and those are used for human beings. Although the animal industry tends to try to make that distinction, the truth is there is a great deal of overlap. And the question, I'm not actually sure about the question in terms of what impact having some allergies to penicillin would have on terms of the meat you're eating. Though, interestingly, I just saw recently a number of hospitals have actually begun offering antibiotic-free meat, in part out of concern for what that might be doing to their patients. So that's one sign, at least, that one part of the healthcare industry is getting worried about what actually eating this will do to their patients.
Maren?
I also just heard about that movement of hospitals to offer antibiotic-free meat. It's more than 300 hospitals across the country, and that is fascinating to me. And it's one of the things that of a number of things that I think shows that the overall market, just everyday consumers, are turning away from this vast use of antibiotics. I mean, Walmart is starting to sell organically raised food. McDonald's is starting to look at its meat provision. When hospitals become concerned about potential drug residues or drug-resistant organisms in what they're giving to their patients, you know that something's shifting. I just want to address that issue of what antibiotics are used. That a moment ago I mentioned legislation in Congress now that would put veterinarians back into the equation. That legislation is called PAMTA, the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act. It was actually introduced by Louise Slaughter of New York, who's Congress's only microbiologist. And what's interesting about that act is that it asks the FDA to look at the control of only the antibiotics that cross over from animal use to human use. But if you actually look at the list, it's a fairly substantial amount of antibiotics. There's seven different families of antibiotics for which the animal and the human versions are pretty close analogs, which is really kind of troubling.
So when some scientist told a listener that the antibiotics used in animal feed are different from the antibiotics that are used against disease, he was not really telling him the truth?
I think that's probably going too far. I don't want to make judgments about that scientist or doctor. They certainly have different names, just as human drugs have different, you know, market names and generic names. And they may have something that's minorly different in the chemical structure. But the important thing to understand is that when bacteria learn to defend themselves against a particular antibiotic, you know, what they're responding to is the chemical structure of the antibiotic. Once they've kind of got that knowledge, they will apply it to anything that looks similar. So anything that's a me too kind of drug, bacteria will become resistant to that as well, even if they haven't encountered that drug. That's the central problem with MRSA or MRSA. The M stands for methicillin, which is a drug that we don't even use anymore. It came on the market in 1960. But the central chemical structure of methicillin is shared by dozens of other antibiotics that we use in medicine every day. And as a result, staff became resistant to all of them.
Well, are we developing new antibiotics to keep up with the mutating bacteria?
Well, yes and no. But when you realize that it takes about a decade and about $1 billion to get a new drug onto the market, and bacteria breed a new generation about every 20 minutes, you can see how they would always win the game of leapfrog. There are new drugs out there, but there aren't very many. A number of companies have withdrawn from the antibiotic market. A lot of the drugs are not actually brand new compounds, but more kind of me too sort of drugs. And And inevitably, when they come on the market, there's resistance appears within a year or two. And so there's only a couple of years when most of the drugs are still good. But when you think of it that way, you can understand why not many pharma companies would want to make them anymore.
Brian, you mentioned earlier the power of the agricultural lobby. What about Big Pharma? What role have they played in this debate? Have they been lobbying against any changes in policy?
Well, they're certainly not anywhere near as visible as what you see with the animal industry. I mean, they're the ones who tend to take this on. They're the ones who do that fight. But I'm sure, you know, I mean, there's clearly an interest here. You know, whatever percentage of antibiotics that do go to the non-therapeutic, to growth promotion in animals, I mean, that is a significant market. And as Maren just pointed out, I mean, antibiotics is, as a whole, in terms of development, not always a winning business proposition. So the idea that, you know, anything that would be closed off in terms of an easy market there, it's not very well regulated, you're just selling it directly to farmers, I'm sure that they would be, you know, against the idea of trying to in any way cut that market down.
Is the particularly virulent strain of E. coli 0157 linked to antibiotic use in beef cattle? And I'm wondering about drug-resistant strains of salmonella and Campylobacter bacteria.
You're right on the mark with Salmonella and Campylobacter. E. coli 0157H7, the hamburger bacteria that we've all heard so much about that can cause lethal illness in children, the primary issue there is not that it is drug resistant. The primary issue is that it has in it a toxin that was imported from other bacteria in a process that's analogous to the way that bacteria exchange resistance information among themselves. But if you want to look at drug resistance spreading in food, then drug-resistant salmonella is a very serious concern, Campylobacter, other similar gut bacteria in animals such as those.
My guests are Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, and a contributing writer for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and Brian Walsh, a staff writer for Time magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Brian, in some ways, is it too late to change now? Hasn't significant damage already been done?
Well, certainly significant damage has already been done. I mean, the way I always see it, you know, it's if we're in an arms race with these microbes, and they can reproduce a lot faster than we can, and we are in danger of losing that. And, you know, the other issue is that with this, the entire meat-producing industry that we have today is, I think, in many ways based around the idea that you do have easy access to these kind of drugs for growth promotion, for health. I mean, the conditions that many animals are kept in when it comes to factory farms, whether that's cattle, pigs, chicken, very close quarters, you know, they're often in – that's very difficult simply to live in. And I think – and many animal experts would agree that it would be very difficult to carry this off, that you would have a lot more fatalities, of a much higher mortality rate if you weren't able to use these antibiotics. In many ways, they are what's keeping the system going. And the idea of dismantling that system, which I think is one reason why the animal health, animal industry tends to oppose this so strongly, is they know it's – take this away, and no one really knows what that could mean for the way we actually produce meat today.
Which is large-scale industrial farms and concentrated animal feeding operations, those CAFOs, which I'm assuming are particularly good breeding grounds for bacteria. Maren, huge factory farms and CAFOs can also be sources of groundwater contamination. Is that a potential
That's
way
right.
for drug-resistant pathogens to spread to humans?
This is one of the things that I think is so important to talk about when we hear farmers say, I can save money when I use small doses of growth-promoting doses of antibiotics in my animals or treat my animals prophylactically, because they're thinking of what's going on their farm and within their family economy, but they're not thinking about the larger impact of what they're doing on their farm. There's very good research that shows that resistant bacteria leave farms not just in the animals, but also in their manure, and not just in manure used as fertilizer, but in dust blowing off manure lagoons, in migration of those organisms into groundwater, even sometimes on the clothes or in the systems of the farm workers when they go home.
So it's spreading in all sorts of ways that go beyond just simply eating the beef. You could be a vegetarian and still be affected.
That's absolutely true.
Are microbes and bacteria on farms monitored?
Well, that depends on who you ask. There are some surveillance systems, but they are partial. For instance, the bacteria that we've been talking about that is sort of my favorite bug, MRSA or MRSA, is not part of, or for most of its existence, was of. There's a system, a federal system, that monitors antibiotic resistance resistant bacteria emerging in animals, in farm animals. And for most of that system's existence, MRSA was not one of the ones monitored. A couple of other bacteria were monitored. So the surveillance is not comprehensive. It uses small data sets, and it really doesn't give us a good, and especially not a nimble or quick sense of what's going on out there.
Now, and certainly, I mean, on the farm, there's very little real studies going on. I mean, even the animal industry will admit that there simply isn't enough data out there. Not enough studies have been done to know what's actually spreading among animals themselves. I mean, that's one big missing part of this puzzle as well.
Maren,
we found that livestock-associated MRSA, the one that emerged in the Netherlands, MRSA, ST398, as it's called, in just one state in the United States, in Iowa. And the reason is because Iowa is the only place that's checked. Now, there's nothing magic about Iowa except that it does have a very large amount of pigs. But if it's in Iowa, it's almost certainly in other states of the Union as well. But no one does the studies, as Brian says, so we don't know.
Brian, Maren was talking about Louise Slaughter's proposed legislation. What kind of support does it have? I'd imagine that in this case, the split will be less along the partisan lines we've been seeing so much of in Congress than farm states versus the rest of the country.
Exactly. I mean, that's where this breaks down. I mean, you can possibly get some Republicans, perhaps, that aren't in farm states to go along with this. I mean, they'll be hearing from their constituents, and this is, frankly, a scary topic. But for farm states, and of course they do have considerable power in Congress and especially in the Senate, I haven't seen anyone who would be supporting something like this. And so even, I think, Congresswoman Slaughter, who's been really great on this issue going forward, admits this is not something that's likely to happen this year, maybe next year. I mean, this is a slow, gradual process, maybe some changes in regulation or what the bureaucracy can do. But it's going to be very hard for Congress because it will be very tough to get the farm states in any way on this.
Now, you mentioned going to Denmark where they changed the policy. What about other parts of the world? Is the EU, does it have a policy on this?
The EU has pretty much followed Denmark in this. I mean, they came later. Denmark was the country taking the lead on this, but they also have moved against the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics within feed animals. Now, of course, elsewhere around the world, and you got to think, meat production is growing hugely in areas of the world like Asia, South America. There, frankly, I very, very little regulation whatsoever. I mean, if you can imagine what's going on here in the United States, I am sort of frightened to imagine what's going on farms in China, where we already have issues we know, again, from avian flu about farmers there using antiviral drugs on their birds, actually helping to spread resistance to H5N1 there. I'm sure there's a huge issue. I know there's a growing issue in terms of antibiotic resistance among people in China, in countries like Japan. So that's something to worry about as well.
Maren, have you been looking into the matter of India and China?
Yeah, I have, and I share Brian's concern. A lot of this issue of antibiotic resistance, as it relates to the use of antibiotics in agriculture, is the unintended consequence of our desire for cheap protein. And that's a desire that now is shared by the growing market economies, particularly of India and China. And from other issues such as the melamine scandal, we know that industrial production and agricultural production in China are kind of a black box. We really can't see into what's going on there. But we know that China has enormous industrial-scale farms now, very, very many. And there are a few signals in the scientific community in Hong Kong that antibiotic-resistant bacteria, similar to the MRSA that was seen in the Netherlands, are now starting to be seen in agricultural imports from the mainland into Hong Kong, and that probably is a warning bell.
A listener, Sue, asks, if the practice of feeding poultry litter to cows was abolished, would there be a reduced need for antibiotics in these feed animals?
Well, that's an interesting question. Your listener knows a lot about agriculture. That's not something that I know a lot about, but intuitively it makes sense, because if since we know that chickens are that are raised in battery conditions are getting antibiotics as well, and we know that any animal that gets antibiotics as part of their presence on the farm doesn't use up 100% of them, but you know the antibiotics end up in their manure, it makes sense that there would be antibiotic residues in that litter if there's chicken manure in the litter. And so if that's going on to be consumed by another animal, that would be something that I'd want to take a look at.
Just one more thing. Benji in Harlem says, it seems like animals have access to cheaper drugs than humans do in this country.
That could possibly be the case, but I don't think you want to be living in the kind of living conditions that they have, that they need for those drugs.
So I love eating from a trough, don't you? I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today. Brian Walsh, staff writer for Time Magazine. Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fetal Menace of MRSA, which is published by Free Press. She's a contributing writer to the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you.